Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, my next guest is just a few days into retirement. On Christmas Eve, Anne O'Mahony left her role as International Programme Director for the aid agency concern. Over the past almost 40 years, Anne's work has taken her to places where human beings are suffering as a result of famine, war, disease and natural disasters. And you'll have heard her often here on Radio 1 reporting from the front lines. So is she putting her feet up for a well-deserved break? Let's find out. Anne O'Mahony, good morning and welcome to the show.
It's lovely to be here, Miriam. Thank
lovely
you for having me.
Lovely to see you here. Listen, we'll talk about all the things you've done and places you've been in a moment. But tell me a little about yourself first. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Bandon in West Cork. And Bandon was a lovely little town. We were about a mile outside the town. I went to school there. All my family and friends and relations were in that area. So it was a nice place to grow up in.
And can you remember, Anne, were you always fascinated by people and places beyond Ireland, even when you were very young?
I was fascinated by places beyond Ireland for a few reasons. I suppose, you know, I went to school in the Presentation Convent in Bandon, and the Cork Mission had an association with a mission in Peru. So priests and nuns would come back from their trips to Peru, talk about what they had done, and it sort of awakened a little bit of excitement in me. Did I want to go out there and see what they were doing? Absolutely yes. But then my uncle was also involved with Amnesty in the UK. And every Christmas, we were asked to send letters to prisoners of conscience around the world. So we wrote to prisoners in places like Nicaragua, that I'd never heard of, but we'd find it on the map anyway, or Moscow or wherever. And it was an interesting introduction to a wider world, and I suppose a world where social justice wasn't as obvious as it should be in the countries or in the places that I grew up in.
You became a nurse, but was the hankering to travel and work in development always there, as you say, partly maybe because of your uncle even?
Well, I did nursing specifically so that I could go overseas. It was the reason I gave in the interviews for nursing. I didn't get the first interview, so I changed my tone a little bit for the second interview, but it was still my driving force for doing nursing. I felt it was the best thing that would enable, it was a passport to travel, really.
What did your family think about Anne, early 20s, wanting to go explore the world and its most dangerous places at that?
I think they were shocked initially and quite thrown by it. And, you know, my first assignment overseas was going away as a volunteer for 2 years. And 2 years when you're that age sounded endless, not only for me, but for them as well. You know, I'd be gone for 2 years to another part of the world. We didn't have our internet, our mobile phones, the connections that we have now. So it was absolutely a big step into the unknown. Of course, they were worried, but also in some ways quite proud, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. At this time of year, of course, many of us are reminded by that Band-Aid song of the horrors that befell Ethiopia in the early 80s. You went there first with Concern in 83, I think. Describe what you saw as a young woman there.
My initial trip into Ethiopia, I went there initially having done a year in Thailand on the Thai-Cambodian border and then transferred to Ethiopia because the famine was growing. I went there initially, I was supposed to relieve some colleagues that were working up in the famine centre in Koram in northern Ethiopia. But on arrival in Ethiopia, they were kidnapped. I was on my way up the road. The road was blocked off. We couldn't go any further. We had to divert into another area and start operations in another area. So it was a rather, I suppose, uncomfortable introduction to Ethiopia. But at the same time, Ethiopia felt like the place that I should be. It felt the right place to be.
Were you not terrified at that moment when you were diverted even?
No, it's funny. I've never felt that I was in any danger ever. I always felt that whatever would happen, I would get through it. We were prepared. We had our running away kits. I would, you know, I'd worked for a year in Thailand. I had all my photographs of a whole life that was so different to the one that I'd left. It was one of the things that I absolutely didn't want to lose if I was kidnapped. So that was the primary focus in my kidnap running away bag to take my photographs with me, because if they were lost, they were lost, and it was going to be a whole portion of my life gone. But in terms of the fear, no, I just never did think anything would happen.
And what about that famine in Ethiopia? I mean, did that almost change your life? You're a very young woman out there. I mean, what impact did that have on you?
The famine was devastating. You know, I suppose I never thought that I would be so up close and personal with people who were struggling to survive, who were dying just because they didn't have food. And it was so wrong. And there were hundreds of thousands of people. It was, I suppose, at the height of the famine, my first trip up to Wallo, you know, you met these almost walking skeletons on the road, dressed in rags, because they had sold their good clothes to get food. And it was streams and streams of people. And we wanted to help them all, but of course we couldn't. So we established a famine relief centre up in a place called Harbo. And we had a big team of people. There was 24 international staff and over 100 national staff, all working on this famine relief centre. And yeah, it was mind-numbing and also life-changing.
But when you're faced with the magnitude of that horror, like as you say, thousands of people starving, is there a part of you that just thinks and feels so helpless that no matter how much you try, can you really ease their suffering and pain?
Well, I suppose for me and for my team, it was about getting that focus in. You know, we had no choice. We had to do something. We had to get moving. We had to get food cooking, and we had to get food out there to the people as quickly as possible. And then, of course, as they began to eat, they also began to present signs of all the various other infections that they were getting. So we had things like measles, we had things like typhoid, we had every illness imaginable coming at us, until we got our whole setup properly organised and structured, with good water services, with good sanitation services, and with the food and the medicines to enable people to get on their feet. One of the benefits for me and for the other humanitarian workers that were there at the time was, while we see people at their absolute worst, we also see them getting better. We see them getting stronger, and we see them going back to their own homes and their own lands. And that is the thing that keeps you going, I think, more than anything else, is that little bit of hope at the end of the tunnel where people actually get better and improve.
Why do you think, I suppose it was those television images that beamed into all of our homes, but why do you think that famine in Ethiopia hit home so hard with people all around the world, as proven by, you know, the extraordinary charitable giving?
That's quite a tough question. You know, I suppose when I was growing up, we had the Biafra famine in 68. And this is when CONCERN was founded. And it had its origins out of the outpouring of the people in Ireland to give that support. And here we were so many years later, and we were seeing the same images again. I think it was the horror of people not having enough to eat. It was the legacy of our own famine, you know, over 100 years before that. And here we are still in this world of plenty. And it is a world that can feed its whole population. And yet there were that number of people that were actually dying for a bite to eat. It was just so wrong, so fundamentally wrong, that I think the world outpouring was a grief that translated itself into assistance so that these people could get back on their feet.
Within 2 years, you were managing a large camp with thousands of people. By then, were you saying to yourself, now this is what I want to do with my life?
It took me a long time to make that conscious decision. You know, I went from year to year. I would extend for another little bit. I got leave of absence from the hospital that I trained in, from the Bonds in Cork. So they gave me 2 years initially, and then I wrote and said, can I have another year? And they said, yes, OK. And then after about two or three more times of doing that, eventually I wrote and did the honourable thing and resigned, because I couldn't in conscience keep my job open.
But
I suppose after maybe 7 or 8 years overseas, I began to realise that there's no way back from here. it gives you, I suppose, a sense of excitement and a sense of achievement, but also a sense of connectedness that I wouldn't have got on a hospital ward back in Ireland.
How dangerous was it for you in these places at that time?
It was dangerous in some places. You know, we work in the most insecure areas in the world, and even still we do. And you know, we work in places from Afghanistan to Syria to South Sudan to all these most difficult places. But we have strong processes and systems in place to keep people safe. And I suppose at the very beginning, it was we developed those processes as we grew into them. We didn't have satellite phones, for example, until 1992 when I was in Somalia. I had the pleasure of ordering Concern's first satellite phone when I was in Mogadishu in 92. The guns were all around the place. There were gunmen everywhere. Our connections with Ireland and with Dublin were very tenuous until we actually got the sat phone. And then all of a sudden, here we were. We were able to pick up and make a phone call without having to travel outside to somebody else's office to do it. And I suppose communication has changed over the years to enable and facilitate a different type of life and a different type of managing risk. So insecurity was part of what we did every day. There were times when I, you know, you're making decisions. Do I enable the team to go out today to work, or do we know of rebels that are involved in the neighbourhood or in the area? And you're sitting there and you're making these decisions and you have to get it right, because you only have one chance to get it right. Otherwise, somebody could get killed. And sometimes you'd be sort of sitting there wishing, I wish I had an easier job. I don't even know why I'm doing this. But then other days, it just works out so well. And keeping people safe while enabling them to do their work was an important part of my decision making on a daily basis.
It's fairly obvious the life of a development aid worker, it isn't always easy. I mean, were there things in your life that you had to compromise on to fit around this incredible international work?
Well, I suppose I've always travelled alone. You know, the minute you get into a relationship, you have to change your decision making. You have to change the choices and the countries that you work in. And these are some of the choices you make. You know, I remember in 92, I was taking time out to do some study in Swansea. And Jack Finucane was Horn of Africa director at that stage. So he rang me up and he was saying, you know, the place is falling apart in Mogadishu. Would you go out? Well, I didn't have to ask anybody. I could just say, yes, I'm going. So I was on the next plane out. And it's that level of flexibility that I think has been an important part of my life. You know, when the tsunami happened in Sri Lanka and Indonesia about 10 years, 11 years ago, on Stephen's Day, a phone call, I was on the next plane. And it's that ability to move around without having a huge consultative process. Can I go? Do I need somebody to mind the children? You know, what happens to the dog? I don't have any of those entanglements, so free to go. And these are the choices I think I have to make, and so have many of my colleagues.
Sounds like there are choices you're happy with. So, you know, you made a decision in a way not to marry,
yes.
Not to have children.
Yes.
Not to have dogs.
Correct.
In that order. And no regrets about that.
And no regrets about that. I might get a dog now that I'm retired.
Look, so much of the work you and colleagues in Concern did came in the wake, of course, of war Ethiopia, we've talked about. You were also in Somalia and Rwanda after the genocide. That must have left you, Anne, with a deep revulsion of violence.
If I look at what the root causes of all of this poverty is, violence has a huge part to play. You know, big men carry guns, and the people who get injured are the women and children that are caught in the middle of all of this. You know, we work with displaced people who have lost their homes more than once. They get displaced, they settle in an area, the gunmen come in again, they get displaced again. And these are people that never get a chance to recover, that never get a chance to rebuild their lives. So you're talking about layering in of poverty on people like that. And it's an absolute disgrace that we would live in a world like this. It's objectionable. There should not be that level of violence and war at this stage.
Because I read a story you told, Anne, about Somalia. I think it was 92. You were working in a feeding centre. and about the child whose hand you were holding. Do you remember that story?
I do. This was in 92. It was a centre called the Pan-Africa Centre, just a few kilometres from the centre of Mogadishu. And we had a feeding centre there, and it was to receive the people not just from the area in Mogadishu, but people were also coming in from surrounding areas like Afgoy. And we were feeding one day, and guns erupted. They even started coming in over the wall around our feeding centre, landing in the food pots. I was holding the hand of a little child, and her stomach was blown away. These are the moments that make me so angry about the injustices in the world. Why should that little child have been killed? On that same day as well, we had a mother dashing into a feeding centre. She was dragging her two little children with her. She had another child on her back. She banged at the door. We opened it when the gunfire, you know, just to let her in out of the gunfire. And when we peeled off the child off her back, the child had been shot. She thought she was sweating down her back, but it was the blood of the child. So I suppose these were the type of scenes that we dealt with on a regular basis in Mogadishu at that time. It was violent. The cost of human life was negligible. And the level of starvation, the warlords ran Mogadishu at that stage. They ran the ports. Aid food would come in on the ships. The trucks would be lined up. They would steal the food off the trucks, put it into their stores and release it back onto the market when the price went up enough for them. They didn't care that half the population in the area was starving because they couldn't get at that very same food that was meant for them, that would enable them to get over the hunger that they were feeling. And it was controlled by these warlords who had no moral compass, had no conscience about what they were doing to their own people.
Which makes me want to ask you this question. Do you believe there is therefore evil in the world? You know, if we believe that all babies are born innocent and good, do people become evil?
I don't know. For me, I think it's much more around greed and corruption. It is this unassailable greed that people think that they're never going to have enough. They're never going to have enough power. They're never going to have enough money. And therefore, they don't care who they walk on to get where they want to be. And I think that is much more of a driver.
Was it hard, Anne, for you, after all those experiences, to come home in 2013 and leave that groundwork to others?
In some ways, it was a very conscious decision to come home. I was lucky I came back into the job of International Programme Director. So it gave me the opportunity to remain connected with the countries that I had loved to work in so much. And I was able to travel quite extensively, visit the countries, have a look at the programmes, have these wonderful conversations with people under trees and all of that sort of thing. And it was good. I suppose the other side of it is it was also time to come home. You know, you can't stay wandering all your life. You have to make connections, make friends, settle someplace so that when I'm now at the stage of retirement, I have friends everywhere. It would have been much more difficult if I was just coming home back to Ireland now, not really knowing anybody or having any close connections. So again, a conscious decision.
The coronavirus epidemic this year, I assume that introduced a whole new challenge for development and aid agencies.
A whole new challenge. And I suppose, you know, we're looking at the effects, not the health effect. The health effect has not been as severe in the countries that we're working in. Well, I don't know why not. We're just not seeing the numbers. Maybe it's a lack of testing, but we're also not seeing a big increase in the number of unexplained deaths in cemeteries or anything like that. And we have been monitoring some of the cemeteries in some of the countries that we're working in. The much greater impact is the impact on the economy. The people that we work with are the people that need to earn money every day to feed their families. If they don't earn money, they don't eat. And these are the people that have lost their jobs when markets have closed down, when farmers are not able to get their produce onto people's tables, when the garment workers, for example, that would supply the likes of Penney's and all the various stores that were in lockdown for so long. They're the people that have lost their jobs. They're the people who get paid piecemeal, but now who don't get paid. Also, many of the people that we also work with might be expecting remittances back from places like Ireland, from the US and the UK. those remittances have stopped as the job markets here have shrunk. So people with very limited coping mechanisms all of a sudden have seen their means of survival eroded. We've done a survey across 23 countries interviewing 14,000 people to get their views of the impact of COVID on their lives over the last number of months. And I suppose some of the outstanding results are the increase in gender-based violence, the increase in inequality. The coronavirus has driven that inequality substantially. We're seeing an increase in debt. Women are going to the loan sharks to get enough money for the next meal. They're also reducing the type of food that they're eating. So they're reducing all the good, more expensive stuff like vegetables and then bulking up on rice, potatoes and maize. And we're also seeing huge differences in access to education. The only way out of poverty for the next generation is through education. Schools have closed down across all the countries that we're working in. Of course, like everybody else, there has been efforts to move online. But if you're living in a slum, you're not connected. There's no way that you can connect into a slum school. And therefore, they're losing a year of education and there's no way back from that.
You strike me as someone, Anne, who's very proud of the work you've done and you should be. Looking back, what do you think were Concern's main achievements during your 38 years there?
I think we have moved and grown a lot as an organisation. We have put an awful lot more into developing staff in the countries that we work in. So I'm very proud of the fact that a lot of our country's directors are national staff from the countries that we work in. I'm also proud of the fact that we have taken gender and looking at women in position of leadership in the countries that we're in. And very proud of many of their progress. And it's lovely to see, actually. I'm also very proud of the fact that we made a huge global contribution to nutrition. We have changed the way the whole humanitarian community, including the UN, manages malnutrition. We designed the system called CMAM. It's the Community Management of Acute Malnutrition, enabling those kids to stay in their communities. And it has changed the face of the way we operate. We have rolled it out across the world. We have worked with governments in the countries that we're in to change their protocols. We managed to influence the World Health Organization to change their protocol. And I'm very proud of the impact that has made. And that is over a period of 20 years.
What now for you, Anne?
For the first time in my life, Miriam, I have no plan. I have to say, I love it.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, I like the idea of just being. And then when I need a plan, I'll make one. And there's lots to do.
Well, Anne O'Mahony, well done to you for your extraordinary career, which is all about helping other people. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Enjoy your retirement and have a wonderful new year in 2021.
Thank you very much, Miriam. Lovely to talk to you.